one of the trickiest things about the difference is understanding this difference between what are the concepts we usually have around meditation and what Nididhyasana is in Vedanta. As I just started touching on this now, we are used to gaining an experience. So when we think of gaining knowledge, we're thinking of gaining an experience, like even a new experience, like traveling to a new place. Now we've traveled to the new place and we're experiencing that new place and we can learn about the new place. But first we have to get to the new place, right? So when we talk about meditation, we're thinking also about getting to a new place, even though it's in an internal realm. We still want to get to a new place, get to a new experience. And this will take us on an endless trip. The reason is that if we're going to get to a new place, what we're setting up for ourselves is simply the creation of a different set of vrittis, a different set of thought modifications. We are not at all looking for or resolving ourselves into the one, the self that is there, present to all of these thought modifications. Like say, this is just in a very simple way. Say now I have an experience of this wall, so I'm looking at this wall, right? And I think, no, I think I should go over to this wall. This wall is a higher consciousness, it's a higher state than that wall. So now I've moved to this wall and I have a new experience. And I think, well, no, this isn't as good as it could be. I'm going to go to this wall. See what I mean? Now say I'm going to have this meditative experience, but I think it can be a better one. And so I'm going to do some more pranayama and whatnot and get into a more absorbed state so that I can have this experience. And then I can say, but, you know, I think I could get a better experience. I could have this experience, and then I could have this experience. Okay, now, all along, what we're doing are creating, you know, different states of mind or different types of subtle experiences, which that's all fine, but that's what it is. I am creating states of experience rather than recognizing the one for whom those states of experience are. Now say, if I'm looking at this wall, I am here, having a vritti, a thought modification of this wall, right? I'm here for that. Now, I'm looking at the corner. I am here for that perception. Now I'm looking at this wall. I am here for that. Now I'm looking at this. I am here for that. This me is changeless. It's not that there's some other me here, right? And so now, what am I doing in meditation? Am I recognizing, am I trying to recognize the self that is ever present, no matter what the vritti? Or am I, vritti means thought modification, right? Or am I trying to create a more subtle thought modification? I can really love the subtle thought modifications. I'm not putting those down. I'm just saying that there is a difference between the changing thought modifications and the one who is present to them, the me, for whom all of those thought modifications are. And so that's why in Nididhyasana, it is not about creating different types of thought modifications. It's about recognizing the one who is stable amidst those thought modifications. And that one is not changing, and that one is never not present. In fact, say if you take your, just take for granted yourself as a body, mind, sense organs, as we just naturally, as agnatis, if you don't have any self-knowledge or anything, you just naturally take yourself to be this body, mind, sense organs complex. The self that you are is always present. Whatever the, you take yourself to be the body, mind, sense organs, it doesn't make any difference. Whatever the experiences you're having, whatever the emotions you're having, whatever the perceptions you're having, however your body is feeling, those are continually changing, but you are always present to them. It's not somebody else. You know, like when you say, we don't think about this logic until it's pointed out, but you don't say, yesterday some, when say you were really sad yesterday, but today you're happy. Okay. You say, yesterday I was really sad, and today I'm so happy, right? So what does that mean? Because the sad person isn't here anymore. The happy person is here, right? Sadness isn't here. Happiness is here now. But you say, you know, I was sad yesterday, and now I am happy. The I is the same. The me is the same. The experience is different. So you could say, I, for me, there was this happy state. There was this sad state of mind. Yesterday, there was a sad state of mind. Today, there's a happy state of mind. We're not going to talk like that, but what if you said that? That's a little bit more reasonable. Because at least I'm giving these changing states or these changing experiences some sort of objectification. Because I am always here no matter what the state, no matter what the thought, no matter what the perception. That matters. Because what it means is that my being, right, that is ever present no matter what the state of experience, is free of that state of experience. It has to be. It has to be free. It's just illogical. Like if they use the one logic, we talked a little bit last week about it. When this is, that is. When this is not, that still is. When this thought is, I am. When the thought is not, I still am. That's a little logic. It's called Nvayavyatireka. What does that mean? It means I have no relationship with the thought. Right? Even we do this simple, even with using japa, but even in vipassana, if you sit, just relax, and allow whatever emotions, whatever experiences are rising up, because your mind is busy, you can also be aware of any, you know, soreness in your knees or whatever in your body. You can be hearing sounds. You just relax and let all of those perceptions take place. Just accept them all, you know. No pushing away, just accept them all. Just to have the totality of the experience, which would be what? You are there. And all of these perceptions are coming and going, and a lot of times there's multi-processing, multitasking going on. But all of them are coming and going and coming and going. Even the perceptions of your physical body, maybe you feel your knee, and then you feel your shoulder, and then you're just relaxing in your whole body. Coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. And what if you notice, which normally is not noticed until it's pointed out, that you're not coming and going. That all coming and going, all experiences, sad experiences, happy experiences, blissful experiences, agitated experiences, depressed experiences, all experiences are coming and going. Some are coming, emotions are moving in a slower wave. Perceptions are like this, you know. It's like music, you know. You've got the bass of the... But all of these things are coming and going, and that's usually all we are noticing because the mind is only kind of lateral. It's only looking at in terms of time. It's had this experience and this experience and this experience, and so it's noticing in this way. But it's never thought to notice in this way. my own being, never coming and going. Never, it's an, even more than that. Not only never coming and going, never affected in any way by what does come and go. See, like you can say like this, I never come and go. I am always stable. I am always free from time and changeless. But then I'll think, but here comes this sorrowful thought. And now the sorrowful thought covers me. Right? And so now I'm affected by the sorrowful thought, just like a cloud coming over the sun covers the sun. And so the sun is affected by that dark rain cloud. It's as though the beautiful sun, even though it's stable and remains at the as a sun, it's now shaded and covered by this dark rain cloud. And so even though I don't change, I still become sad and happy and, you know, depressed and joyful and blissful and agitated and angry, because all of these states of mind come and they cover me. That's how we can start to think. It's often, people would always be asking Swamiji a question like this, you know. Swamiji, when will I know who I am, Swamiji? I know who I am, but I keep getting covered, you know, by these rain clouds. I keep getting covered, you know. But in fact, you're never covered. The sun is never covered. It's illumining the cloud. It's illumining the clear day. It's illumining the little cloud puffs. It's illumining the thunderstorm. The sun isn't affected at all, you know. Now you can think, well, yeah, the sun isn't affected, but, you know, in this case, in this case, it's the mind, the dark rain cloud of the mind that is unable to perceive and to experience the sun because of its dark, you know, depressed state. It's unable to experience the sun, even though the sun is there. Right? You say, no, that isn't true. The sun, right? The sun is the luminary. I am the luminary. I am the conscious being that's illumining the dark state. And I am the conscious being that's illumining the happy state. So conscious being isn't becoming anything different. It really makes no difference to whether it's a dark state or a light state to your being. It's not like your being becomes covered. Now, the problem is, you know, when your arm is broken, you know, you need like some pain medication, and you need to put a cast on it, you know, and take care of that problem, you know. Because it's very, very painful, right? So you need to take care of the problem. And so at that time, your mind isn't thinking, you know, my problem is secondary and nothing's really happening to me. Right? It tends not to be thinking like that. Until you're more mature in your knowledge. But I'll tell you some stories about Swamiji in a minute about this. It's important, even because the mind and the body are capable of creating a lot of pain. Both are, you know, a lot of pain. You know, it becomes really, really useful to, in spite of that pain, admitting the emotional pain, recognizing that it is not exactly desirable, you know. It is what it is. It's not something that I desire, you know. But there's something to recognize, there's something to make use of when that emotional pain is there. And that is to see to what extent it's actually covering your own being. And what you find is that it's not covering you at all. And then, which is even more difficult than that, I think, is that when your mind is very quiet and blissful, there's a shantavritti, it's very quiet and blissful, to recognize that that state is also not covering your being, and that there is a differentiation between the mental state, whether negative or positive, and yourself. Yourself isn't modified or changed or covered in any way by the states, even by the mental states. Even though there's some that are painful and there's some that are pleasurable, nothing is happening to you. And that's like nothing is happening to the sun. The sun isn't saying, oh my God, the storm cloud is covering me. There, in fact, is no such experience from the standpoint of you. And it's not saying, oh, thank God, it's a clear day now. The sun, it makes no difference at all. And so now, when we're doing Nididhyasana, this has to be unfolded in many, many different ways, because it is our tendency to create shantavrittis so that we can be having an experience of ourself. But what we're having is an experience of the shantavritti. And the shantavritti is more mirror-like to my nature than the dark vrittis. And so I will equate self-knowledge with an increase in shantavrittis, as though I'm having now experiences of myself. And you know what? That will go on forever. And the vrittis will go on changing, and the vrittis will go on modifying. They'll be going from more tamas to more rajas, to more sattva, in all different combinations, because that's the nature of prakriti. And you'll be wondering when you will only have shantavrittis. Because it's only when you only have the shantavrittis. You know, shanti means peace, and vritti means those thought modifications that are very peaceful. It's only when I only have the shantavrittis that I have jnana nishtha. Never going to happen. Because the mind is prakriti. Prakriti is made of sattva, rajas, and tamas. You may not, what will happen is as you start to differentiate the stability of your own being, there's nobody building up on whatever vritti you have. If you have a dukkha vritti or a sukha vritti, fine, it's an experience, that's all. Like Swamiji said, my mind does all kinds of funny things. Who cares? It doesn't make any difference. There's nobody there building up on all of that. Because it has nothing to do with me. These vrittis don't touch me in any way. Not at all. They do not have that capacity. Just like the clouds aren't touching the sun. For the sun is just the sun. It's its own experience. Now there's another pretty important thing to recognize here. In the teaching, the Drik Drisha Viveka, the different types of prakriyas, teaching methodologies that we have, one which is that seer seen analysis, right? Where everything that I had taken to be myself is now objectified. And when I objectify, I'm the subject and I'm looking at this. So when I'm looking at something and I'm recognizing that it comes and goes and it changes, then I recognize I'm not that thing. That experience that's coming and going. So it gets objectified, put into the world of objects. As I do that Drik Drisha Viveka, that discrimination, all of my sense organs get objectified. They become only instruments. What does that mean? Is that I can see because I have eyes. I can hear because I have ears. If I don't have these instruments, then I can't do what those instruments do. I illumine the instrument that is not working. Right? And so seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling take place because of these instruments, which conscious being illumines. Or I can say, going just to step inward, I could say, these instruments, just in my experience, the instruments of my sense organs, they function because my mind is using them. If my mind is daydreaming or thinking about something else, these instruments are there, but they're not being used. I'm off in my daydream, or I'm off lost in my thoughts. I'm not using the sense organ. These are simply instruments that can be used or not used. See what I mean? They're not me. They're instruments which I use or I don't use. That means that the self, yourself, is not a seer. It's not a hearer. It's not a thinker. It's not a hearer. It's not a toucher, a taster, etc. Those functions belong to the sense organs. And then you could say, well, the mind uses the sense organs, so I must be my mind. But the mind also is objectified. What does the mind do? It has emotions. It has memories. It has intellections, the buddhi, you know. It has a fluctuating thinking. It has emotions, all of these things, right? Those functions belong to the mind buddhi. The manas is more the fluctuating mind, and the emotions are put in the manas. The chitta are all of the memories, right? The buddhi are all of the intellections and thoughts and clarity of knowledge. Those are all functions that belong to the mind. I illumine the mind. I'm not a thinker. I don't emote. Right? I don't have emotions. All of those things, I don't have memories. All of those things belong to the instrument, the buddhi in the mind. Right? So for me, the luminary, you know, what am I doing? I don't have arms or legs. The body has arms and legs, right? I'm not a man or a woman. The body is a man or a woman. I'm not young or old. The body is young or old. So if I am just focusing on my own being, just being myself, everything that would allow me to be a participant in the world requires an upadhi. My body, my mind, my sense organs, my buddhi, all of these things are what is necessary to make me a knower, seer, enjoyer. So from the standpoint of just my being, me, right now I'm talking, right now, what am I experiencing? Just from my own standpoint. Any experience that you're having within duality requires an upadhi, a conditioning adjunct, your body, mind, sense organs. But the body, mind, sense organs belongs to the creation. It exists within time and space. It comes into being, it goes out of being. I'm not an object in the creation. I am not thinking, I am not feeling, I am not seeing, I'm not grasping, I'm not walking, I'm not talking. Right now I'm not. Talking, I'm not talking. Seeing, I'm not seeing. Hearing, I'm not hearing. There's a viveka that has to take place where you recognize that right now, in this moment, I simply am. And all of this other stuff is taking place also. You know? So if I simply am in this moment, what is actually happening to me? If I myself am free of the upadhis, if I am free of the mind, whatever the mind is thinking, that's not happening to me. The mind is thinking. The mind is having emotions. Emotions are taking place in the mind. Are emotions taking place in me? No. If I'm seeing, right? sight is taking place, I'm having a vritti in the mind. But am I having a vritti? Right? And so this is the level of the viveka, something that we're not used to. Even in the Vedanta, the Vedanta is taught, it's very disconcerting, can be, until you understand it. You mean I'm not a knower? I'm not a thinker? I'm not a, you know, emoter? I'm just simply me. I'm not doing anything, nor am I experiencing anything from my own standpoint. Now, the thing is, how does that feel? Well, it's what's happening right now. So that's how it feels. It's what's happening right now. Nothing else is, but this is happening. It's just that you are only thinking of yourself from the standpoint of upadi, from the standpoint of your body, from the standpoint of your body, mind, sense organs, from the standpoint of your quality of your thoughts, from the standpoint of your emotions. So all of your self-experience is always coming in through the upadi, not conditioning adjuncts, not from just your own being. So now we have to recognize who I really am and that nothing is happening to me at all, zero. That in fact I have no history, that I have no future, that I have no time, that I simply am, you know, and that everything enjoys this amness that is me. There is nothing in this room. See, everything in this, look at this, we have this room here with all of us in it, right? But for each one of us, we're all in the same, exactly the same boat. For each one of us, this body is objectified. For all of us, this body is objectified. I'm aware of it. I illuminate. The sense organs are objectified. Each one of us. So notice they're all being given back to the room. Right? Your emotions are objectified. Your thoughts are objectified. Even the I notion, I am me and you are you. That's a thought. That's objectified. Space is objectified. The room is objectified. Time is objectified. For each one of us, everything that would differentiate you from me is objectified. If you think in the dream, the whole dream, and everyone in the dream, right? Everyone in the dream, even the insentient things and even the trees and the animals and the butterflies and the clouds and the sun and the rocks, everything that makes up that dream panorama and all of the beings in it, it's the whole thing is objectified. The whole thing belongs to the dream. It's one panorama that includes all beings, all thoughts, all feelings, all everything. Everything is the same dream material, right? I know that, that's fine with me. That's the nature of a dream. But the fact is that whole dream enjoys me, right? Every dream character has me as its being. And the entire dream has me as its being. All the animals have me as their being. All of the plants, all of the rocks, all of the clouds, the whole sun, the sun. Absolutely the whole dream has me as its being. But the knowership, now think about this. So that's, yeah, I see that. But this is something important you have to see about that. The dream experience requires the dream to be there. If the dream isn't there, there's no dream experience. The dream experience as a whole would be Ishvara. That manifestation has to be there in order for it to be experienced. The self isn't experiencing it. Because the dream is there, it is experienced. But there's nobody experiencing it. It's the conscious being in which the dream takes place, lights up that dream, right? And so the dream is experienced from its own standpoint. All the dream characters in the dream, they are experienced from their own standpoint, and they experience from their own standpoint, not from the standpoint of the conscious being, you know, that is the self of the entire dream. And then when that dream goes away, you wake up from the dream, that is a very enlightening experience. Because when you wake up from that dream, all of the experience of the dream is gone. All of the characters in the dream and their experiences are gone. The whole dream is gone. And your experience as the very self of the dream could say, if I'm from the waking state, my mind could say something like, that dream was so real when it was happening, and yet when I wake up from it, nothing has happened. Have you had that experience? It's really a very profound experience. The dream was so real, but all of the namarupas, all of the name and form, go away completely. All of the activity was going on. That whole thing is gone, and yet nothing has happened. Because what was actually there in reality was me, my being. Not my being as a knower, because that would have been lost. I didn't lose anything. Nothing at all has happened. That's why this dream is kind of the Achilles heel of this waking state. Because what the difference is that for that dream character to recognize within the dream what's really going on, right? To recognize what's really going on, he needs a dream guru. Yeah. Here we are, in this infinite dream of Ishvara, that we call Ishvara, you know, and we need a dream guru to make us recognize that actually I'm just me, the conscious being from which this whole infinite creation has come. And this me that is so profoundly me and so simply me is the me of all beings. This simple me that is only me is the only me of all beings, is the only me of Ishvara. There's not another me. There's not another me experience. Just think of the dream. The me experience of the dream is the me experience that the entire dream enjoys and every character in the dream enjoys. The knowership and enjoyership and all of that belongs to the different upadis. But the me experience is the one non-dual experience that the whole dream enjoys that is inviolate. Nothing happens to it. That me experience is the same me experience that is here. The waking state has a bigger reality, so to speak, in reference to the dream state, but in reference to the self, it's exactly the same. There's no difference at all. And so now, what does that mean? Think of the dream character trying to meditate. And the dream character is trying to produce bliss vrittis. You know? But the bliss vrittis, meditative states of experience that are enlightened states of experience, we think, those vrittis exist within time and space. They come and go. They belong to the creation. What doesn't come and go is the me experience. That doesn't come and go. That me experience that is ever present is what has to be recognized no matter what the vritti. You can't use your vrittis as an excuse. Whatever they are, you are there as the very truth of that vritti. So don't say, I'm sad so I don't know myself, or I need to have this type of a thought or this type of a feeling, or life has to be like this in order for me to recognize myself. It really doesn't. You are there no matter what the experience is. The experiences are changing. You're not. Your being isn't. And so don't look for these vrittis. Recognize yourself in whatever the vritti is. And so when we talk about meditation, It's nice to calm everything down, calm your mind down, you know, even do some pranayama, do some inner child work, do some work with people you don't like and that are creating all these negative vrittis. That's a good thing to do, just to kind of purify the upadi, your body, mind, sense organs, bring it into a state of relaxation. There's nothing wrong with that. But you're only doing that just to get rid of noise so that you can just sit with yourself and let your mind learn, come into relationship with really yourself, which is the very source of the ananda that you seek. That's why you're doing all of that. But what if your orientation is this? I have to calm down all these vrittis. You know, I have to be loving and kind to all of these people. I think that's important, actually. But so that I can generate this type of an experience, so that I can experience the self. This is there in so many subtle ways. You're doing all these things so you can experience the self. No. The self is already there, even in your most awful vritti. And so you're not going to, what do you call, vritti hop. Like jump vrittis or something, to get to that ultimate vritti. There is no ultimate vritti. Right? There's no ultimate vritti. And even if there was one, it's going to be time bound. So that'll be really disappointing.
It'll go away.
But no ultimate vritti is as good as any match for the wholeness of your own self, you know. And so we do a lot of sadhana to bring our to keep our body healthy, and to bring our mind into relationship with Ishvara, into conformity with Ishvara, Dharma, so that we're not generating all these negative vrittis. You know, we have no need to generate these negative vrittis when the ananda that I seek, I am. So why am I acting in the world in a way that creates pain, when the truth of it, of all the teaching, of everything I see at the time of teaching, is that I'm the very fullness, the very ananda that I seek, and no one can add that or take away from it. Nothing can be done about it. I can't make it better. I can't make it worse. I have no history. I simply am the ananda that I seek. So why am I putting my mind through all of these turmoil, hurting myself and hurting others, for absolutely nothing? So this, I mean, nothing, because yourself isn't benefiting in any way. You're not improving your lot. In fact, if anything improves the lot of the upadis, your body, mind, sense, or it's all simply dharma, because dharma is in conformity. It's not rubbing in against Ishvara. And so your body, mind, sense organs become, for the most part, kind of invisible. It's like when your body is really healthy and well exercised. They say you do yoga or you eat well and all of that. Your body is invisible. It's just an instrument that you're using. But it's not saying, my knee, or, you know what I mean? It's just functioning. It's no problem. Your mind also becomes just an instrument. It's not something that's in turmoil and creating pain for yourself and others. So all of that becomes so possible for us as jnanis because I am what I seek. If I don't know that I am what I seek, I'm projecting what I am onto something else and going after that. But if I've recognized I am what I seek, then I'm just living my life in the moment, doing my dharma to the best of my ability, because I don't really need the world to be in a particular way. I can just accept the world as Ishvara and do what's asked of me moment to moment to moment, enjoying the ahistorical nature of myself, which is never going to be any different than it is. Say if you think that you're going to improve yourself. This is a big problem. If I could improve myself, my God, I'm going to do that, you know. So why just improve what you can improve? You're not going to improve your being. Ananda is Ananda. You're free from time. There's no improvement here. There's just recognition. And that recognition is so, and it's such an amazing, amazing thing. Our mind works very, very quickly. It's only used to jumping, hopping all around. So we have to stop the hopping and try to live much more in the present, recognizing myself. So I'd say in meditation, nididhyasana, something happens throughout the day. It happens in your own. You take a little time out of the day to have your own practice, but it happens throughout the day. And what I think, how it looks is like this. You are continually throughout the day, when your mind runs off into its fantasy world, you bring it back to the present. And when you bring your mind back to the present, you're, in the sense, you're bringing your mind back to your knowledge, where you recognize your own presence and you recognize the moment that you are living in, which is Ishvara. This moment that you're living in is your prarabdha karma. And there's things to be done in this moment. It's all Ishvara in this moment. So you get used to living in the present and doing the things that are asked of you in the present, all the while enjoying your own, bringing your mind back to your own presence. The present as Ishvara and the presence of yourself. So this body, mind, sense organs belongs to the present, which is Ishvara. And that Ishvara is taking place in the presence of your being. So this recognition is something, it's a recognition, it's not just an intellection, it's a seeing it. That bringing your mind back throughout the day. Because throughout the day you'll find your mind spinning off into absolutely useless, time-wasting concoctions that are not rooted in reality. They have nothing to do with reality. They have to do with your fears and aspirations, and you've already jumped, you know, several years ahead in some imaginal world. That's not helpful. And so every time you see, even in your fears about other people, your fears about so-and-so is going to do this, or that's going to happen with this person, or this thing's not going to work out, or whatever it is, as soon as that happens, as a sadhana, this nididhyasana, you bring your mind back to the present, to your knowledge. And that's a training of the mind, because you've spent actually lifetimes, infinite lifetimes, running after these, living in this imaginal world. I would say maybe 90% of your life is lived in that imaginal world. It's really pretty bad. Yeah. I mean, that's really something. And to just experiment with living here, with your, you know, recognizing your own being and recognizing what is at best of you by Bhagavan at this minute, at this moment. That's it. And it's hard to realize that that's it. So you have to practice. And then you start getting a lot of relief, because it's actually that very stable, very solid way to be. It's very real. It's very practical. You're in Ishvara Srishti. You're in Bhagavan's creation. You're not just in Jiva Srishti. Jiva Srishti is full of pain and worry and fear. It's all like jnanam based. Ishvara Srishti is practical. and it is here. Okay, so let's take a few minutes and I'll do a little more meditation. Now, just as you sit in the present, just let yourself mull over a little bit. What it would mean for you to just actually live in the present and act out of the present. Spending more time just differentiating itself from your own, the stability of your own being. Just relax, let yourself just totally accept or welcome whatever thoughts or discomforts or anxiousness, whatever might be passing your way, boredom, whatever. Just allow it to be. Just notice your own presence. Relax. See if you can notice the changelessness of yourself. You're really not doing anything other than being. Conscious being. Me. Sometimes I say conscious being, meaning me, using the word me, because it's more personal. Throughout the day, keep bringing your mind back to the present. Not as a big deal, just do it. It takes not even a split second. When you notice your mind is running off into some fantasy, just come home. Just get used to spending more time with yourself, with Ishvara. goes down, living in Ishwara's time instead of the Jiva's imaginal time. An emotion or a difficult thought, try just welcoming it. It's okay. It's just a thought. You can be with me. Bring your mind back to your knowledge. It's okay, you can be difficult, doesn't matter. I can be with you. Bringing your mind back to your knowledge, to yourself, is not harmed in any way. Find yourself getting uptight. Say, relax, it doesn't matter. I'm fine. Slow down. Thank you.
your presence in you, but yet you're going on talking to this guy.
Well, the thing is, that's why it takes some practice, and maybe it takes, it's nice to do some contemplation by yourself so that you can get used to noticing as your mind starts to go off. Because you can change it midstream, you know. Say you're starting to build up. You can actually start to catch your mind doing that as it starts and realize you don't want to go there, you know. But we're so, the mind initially gets a real jump on you. And so then somehow you have to let it hi, Tibby. So you have to let it unwind, you know. But what you learn to do is it's really a control of the mind. Your mind gets something that's in your hand that you have actually control on, whether you're going to let your mind run, you know, and take you away with it, or if you're going to bring it home. You know,
it's not a multitask process where you're doing both at the same time.
Well, you do in a way. You catch yourself and bring your mind back. You can catch yourself on a dime. I mean, you're right. Your being is right there. Your knowledge is right there. Your mind's starting to take off. You notice that it's taking off in a direction that's not really going to do anything positive for you at all. Right? But that also takes some vairagya, dispassion, to actually realize that, because there can be all kinds of justifications about why it's perfectly legitimate for you to go off in this, you know, angry, but it's just pain producing for all involved. And at some point you realize that and you don't want to do that anymore. So your practice of nididhyasana, like if you do spend any time meditating, or you're taking a nice walk or something, then you can just easily bring your mind back all of the time until you develop, the mind develops that capacity. Because chances are great that it doesn't have that capacity initially. Right? That's why nididhyasana is even there. Otherwise, we just have shravana and manana.
Yeah.
We have nididhyasana because the mind has this habitual behavior patterns. You know? Radically what?
It's only not, as you started saying today, contemplation is a dawn, but not something that is doable outside of the Parmesan.
Well, because if there's no self-knowledge there,
right,
well, then it's just a practice, right?
The notion is that by allowing everything to drop away,
yeah,
that there's some innate, almost a romantic notion, but it is a there's a faith, if you will.
Yeah.
That through 10 days of complete silence, the mind will sufficiently calm that some greater ground of being, which is not actually teachable,
yeah,
impossible to be taught, can and only can through that process emerge.
Well, we wouldn't accept that in Vedanta, because there's a difference here in terms of teaching methodology. And the difference, say, in more of a Buddhist perspective, is that words themselves already have their definition, so within duality. And so any words or any teaching are only going to land you within duality. And so that's not it. But in Vedanta, the teaching methodology is called Lakshana, and it's because you are there, your being is there, and it's self-evident. The mind can be directed to that recognition. The recognition is there to be had. Now, you can say that you can do it by sitting in Vipassana for 10 days in a row, meditating all day. That will definitely have an experiential effect. You know, but then when you leave the Vipassana, chances are that the samsara itself will then overwhelm the mind again. So maybe then you would think, well, I have to sit in Vipassana for years and years and years like that, okay, to somehow condition the mind, or to wear the mind out, you can say, to wear the mind out so that the self becomes more dominant. But we say that the self is already completely there and completely dominant, you know, for once it's pointed out, the mind starts to come into relationship with what is always there to be recognized. You know, and then you can, if you've seen it at the time of teaching, then you can bring your mind back to it continually. It's even when you're bringing your mind back to it, it's not as though it's not there. I don't know if we're talking about the same thing or not.
I think so, because Swamiji said that he thought that Vipassana was dangerous. He went that far.
Well, you know why? I think from I've heard a little bit about this. He felt that it totally dulls the mind, because you're trying to burn your mind out, basically.
Right.
Yeah. And that we have no reason to burn the mind out. If you get rid of the ignorance, once you understand that everything that you seek really is the ananda of your own being, then you can actually be present. You can use your mind as an instrument. You can live in this world. You can enjoy your prarabdha karma, the very karmas that brought you here. This is your life. You can be present to Ishvara. Yourself is not being hurt in any way, nor are you going to make it better.
But this process of bringing the mind back, it's not a step-by-step.
No, it's instantaneous. Because your mind, yourself, is the self of every vritti. So there's no distance between yourself and a given vritti. So say if you say it's linear, here's yourself, and the mind is going like this, and so you're chasing the mind, that's not going to work. Every single vritti along the way has only your changeless being as itself. So there's no route to take. There's an instantaneous recognition of your own presence.
So the bringing the mind back is kind of that...
knowledge.
Yeah.
It's just knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's instantaneous. Also, we learn... There's some things that are counterintuitive. Rather than push away what you don't like, welcome it. It's kind of like Rumi and all the Rumi's poetry. Instead of pushing away what you don't like or trying to make it go away, you say, no, you can be with me, no problem. And then what happens is your buddhi itself, the one that has knowledge, there's no stress there. And so then whatever you thought the problem was becomes... the experience becomes very diffuse because there's nobody pushing away. And so then that problem dissipates. The problem you thought was there dissipates because it's not a problem for you. You're not making it into a problem. People don't have to be a problem for you. They could be real jerky jerks, so to speak, with, you know. But you... I mean, that's the world, right? But you don't have to. How are you responding to it? Are you responding to it as this is some huge problem? Or is it just an objective problem that has to be dealt with, but I'm fine? Why do I have to be ripped to shreds by my attachment to the how you think things should be? You know, we get very attached to how we think things could be, but you know what? Things aren't like that. They're like this. So what you think things should be might be incorrect. You have to deal with how things are, you know, and you find yourself right in the middle of that situation. I'm not talking about trying to join a bad situation in a bad way. I'm talking about your attitude. Like Swamiji has done so much good for the world. He didn't become in the middle of things that are really a dharmic. He didn't ever become a dharmic. But he just dealt with it objectively and did what he can to make something right. To make it something where people were not being hurting each other or being hurt. You know?
And all those good things he did didn't make him a bigger person or a bigger self to himself.
Not to himself, but actually, the more free you are, the more free you are. The less you react, the less you react. And then it's not like you just become a blob. It's that you become objective and can do what's called upon in a given situation in a way that is not harmful to yourself or others. A hymn song, you know? What the sannyasa vow, abhayam. Let me not be afraid of any being, and let no being be afraid of me. Well, we've talked on this quite a bit, but it's so profound because for me to not be afraid of any being means I accept them as they are. I don't feel that I'm not afraid of them hurting me. And if I can accept people as they are, not be afraid of any being or not be afraid of any person, then they're not going to be afraid of me. Right? So that's the double edge of the sannyasa vow. Let no being be afraid. I always say it this way because in order for the other half to be true, you have to not be afraid of them. You know, we're afraid of people hurting us in this way or that, or their vibe, or their stupid way they are, or whatever. You know, discombobulates us. So we're afraid of them. We don't want to deal with them. But what if I don't look at people in that way? I want to deal with you or don't want to deal with you. It's Ishwara. This is what it is right now. You know? Otherwise, what am I going to do? Okay, this is what it is, but now you've got to go and you've got to go and this has got to happen and this has got to happen and then I could be okay. But that is so unrealistic. It's not real. That's not real. What's real is what's here right now. And so how to be with it. That is nitya dhyasana, actually. Either you're in nitya dhyasana or you're meditating. You're bringing that reality to you. We wouldn't even have the word. Nitya dhyasana means you're contemplating. You're bringing your knowledge. You're bringing that knowledge back. Bringing your mind back to your knowledge. If your mind is just with your knowledge, then that nitya dhyasana is just happening. It's how it is. Or you're doing nitya dhyasana to bring your mind back to that. That's why Shankara, the Aparokshana Bhuti, says, what do you mean? Do I have to sit? Do I have to do something special for nitya dhyasana? He jokes about it. Just to bring this point home.
Yeah. So it sounds like actually you're postulating three different ways of doing the dhyasana. One is you can sit down and contemplate for a while. The other is you're just walking around in it. You're just in your knowledge. And then the third one is recognizing that you're not and bringing it back.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's important to kind of understand that because otherwise you just think of, first of all, you just think you have to go sit in meditation for a half an hour, so that's it. You know, it's happening all the time. Even in when teaching is taking place, those moments of seeing, where your mind resolves, like you see it, that's a moment of nitya dhyasana. Yeah.
Well, is this an easy task or a difficult task or a complicated task? The approach to this, you know?
It's actually very simple, but then for your mind to remember to do it, want to do it, that's where the vairagya and also your own raga dveshas, your likes and dislikes, and your different things that you have to, the different ways that the mind has to calm down in the light of your knowledge. That's why it kind of seems difficult, because there's pressure. Your psyche has pressure, you know, about the way things should be or what should be done or what you need or the very hurts that you have and all of these things. It takes time for all of that to work out. Next week we're going to do more on inner child work and all of these types of things that we have to do in order to calm down some of the hurts and problems that are creating pressure.
So what would you say if your approach is, oh, this is hard, this is a tedious, difficult. I mean, what is, how do you handle that emotion?
Well, bring it up in satsang. But I'll know, but I'll also. Maybe you can tell yourself, you know, it doesn't matter if it's hard or not, if it's what you want to do. You know, who cares? So it's hard.
It's hard not doing it, so. Yeah.
Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of something being hard. That kind of doesn't.
Shit's hard. Otherwise, you wouldn't make the trek to do it.
Yeah.
I had read this really nice thing the other day on Facebook. Somebody put it about Ramana. People were asking Ramana about Hatha Yoga and the asanas and all this. Was it good?
Yeah.
And by many, well, really the best asana is Nididhyasana. So what is Nididhyasana? I mean, the word itself?
No, what it is ni plus Nididhyasana. But I haven't got a good definition of it. The ni is an upasarga, and it means, you know, firmness. Yeah. And Dhyasana gets a duplication for intensity, Dhyasana. So it's ni plus Dhyasana. And the root is Dhyasana, but I still, in fact, I told Edward I was going to do the etymology and that I started on it, but I'm not satisfied because I don't have the right.
So Ramana was making a pun then, pulling asana out.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought
it was
Nidhi
and asana. So somehow.
Well, not from the dictionaries I'm looking at.
I didn't
realize this. Well, is it obscure? Is it obscure in the dictionaries? Is that why the...
Well, I need the... There's a different... The dictionaries that I have or that most of us use is not the right one. There's... Swamiji has... Actually, he has my copy of it, and now who knows where it is. But what it does is it gives a very thorough... It's in Sanskrit. But it gives a very thorough breakdown of these words, you know. It's like a dictionary, but a different type of dictionary. Etymological dictionary. It's really a nice thing. But I can still work on it and found it. I should know that.
Yeah. Is that the roots and the stems?
Yeah, yeah.
I saw one at Shakespeare a couple years ago.
The root?
It was in English. It was an analysis of the different... parts of words in Sanskrit.
Oh, in Sanskrit?
No, of Sanskrit, but in English.
Oh, I see. Well, that's
interesting. It was in Sanskrit. I don't know. It was way beyond where I was.
I actually think when I go to the ashram, I think that book's, it's probably back in print. It's a really important book.
Which ashram?
When I go to India.
Good question, Carol. I'm so confused. I understand the idea of not wanting to chase the experience of that you need an experience of yourself. And it's has to be a meditative experience.
But why did I say that? Because the experience of yourself is already completely present.
But the thing that I find confusing is it does seem easier to for your mind to recognize yourself in contemplation.
Yeah, because your mind isn't distracted by anything else. Yeah.
So I guess what's a little confusing to me is like I see that it's a trap if you start thinking that way, but it seems necessary, or the practice seems necessary.
No, let me make it a little bit more clear. When you're sitting in contemplation, your mind has a task, right? And that task is, I can say it in many different ways, but it's to own up your knowledge or to recognize your own presence. For the mind to recognize the stability of its own being in reference to its own self. Okay. And so every vritti, the different vrittis are still going to be the same recognition of that which is not changing. And so it's what tends to happen, unless this is made clear, very clear to people from a lot of different angles, I found, because the concept is so strong in people. what the thought is that you are having a vritti of yourself. And so in meditation, you're working to have a vritti of yourself. You're not having a vritti of yourself. In this way, the self is the luminary. It is self-evident. It's self-experienced. There's no subject-object relationship there. It's self-shining. So that self-shining self-experience is there with or without the creation. And so the vrittis have to differentiate themselves from me, that is the one illumining, and the self of those vrittis, which is different than thinking that the vritti is going to have an experience of the self. The vritti is going to recognize itself as the illumined and me as the luminary. So that there's, at any given moment, there are two things happening simultaneously. The changeless, self-evident me, self-shining me, with or without the creation, I am self-shining, I am my own experience, with or without the creation, with or without the mind. And there are the mithya vrittis, right, which enjoy me. But I'm the luminary, not the mind. And so the mind has to recognize its mithya nature, right? But it itself is not turning and having an experience of me. It's differentiating itself, you know, from the self-evident nature of me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so like you're not trying to have an experience of yourself, you're trying to have an experience of the true nature of your mind in that moment.
Yes, and the true nature of yourself.
But that's always there.
That's always there. But you are usually experiencing it only through the dress of your mind, rather than seeing, recognizing me as absolutely changeless, and the self of every vritti.
So it doesn't need a vritti.
The self doesn't. Self experience needs no vritti. It needs no universe. It needs nothing.
So is it possible then to go beyond the mind?
Yes, because
completely. I mean, to not be in no vritti at all.
Well, as
I'm
long
not talking about some weird samadhi.
Yeah. Well. Say like in, if the universe is not here, that's fine. Nothing happens to you. You don't need a vritti to be. Your being doesn't depend upon a vritti. And so now, as long as you have body, mind, sense organs, there's going to be vrittis, but what you recognize is that those vrittis come and go and nothing happens to you. And so there's no sangha, there's no relationship between you and these changing nature of vrittis.
So it seems to me then that I guess I'm saying this so I can be corrected, the case that every experience then is technically a non-dual experience.
Every experience, that's right.
It's not like I'm walking around not having non-dual, but then I did some processes and I got a non-dual experience.
Every experience is non-dual.
Complete misunderstanding.
Yeah, and the reason it's non-dual is because mithya. It's like the clay pot is non-dual clay. Because mithya doesn't add or subtract anything to it. Its being is only clay. And so the being of every experience you have is only consciousness. Yeah.
I guess it'd have to be that or else no experience would be one or the other.
Yeah.
It couldn't be some of the other.
Yeah, that's right. It can't be both.
I'm just wondering, you know, one thing we've talked about is if you, and you kind of hinted at this today, that acting dharmically leads down to karma shuddhi. That makes it easier to do nidhyasana.
Yeah, or to even be available for knowledge.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that seems, you know, somehow I'm wondering, how does that square with, well, I'm here no matter what I'm thinking or what's going on?
If your buddhi is capable of realizing that, then there's no problem. But sometimes, because of your likes and dislikes, your raga dvesha, your reaction, the reacting mind and all of this, the mind's not really had the space for that recognition. And it's also justifying, you know, it's very engaged in the reactive, very engaged in the world, and doesn't really have space to see, to recognize all of that, nor desire to.
So that suggests that there are there is a usefulness to contemplation and even, you know, some kinds of meditation that might be calming and so on.
Absolutely. Yoga, Hatha Yoga, Pranayama, all of these things, Qigong, all of these things are extremely useful because they make your body relax. They give your mind a certain relative shanti. The problem comes in is if you think that that relative shanti is going to itself culminate in an absolute shanti.
I guess it's a confusion between, it seems like the relative shanti is a relative freedom from disturbance that can be distracting. And if that's out of the way, then it feels better, but that feeling better isn't itself
the freedom.
The freedom.
No, that's right. But the mind is much more available when the teaching is taking place or when you're trying to contemplate. The mind is much more available for that realization. Because otherwise it's agitated, it's distracted, it has desires, it wants this and that and this, and so it wants that more than to just be able to see, to recognize.
So all those practices that just lead in one way or another to Vairagya can have a benefit.
They definitely have a benefit.
The kind of side effects of Vairagya with.
Yeah, they all have a benefit in terms of making your mind more available to gain this knowledge. But if you think that the mind itself is going to reach a state of enlightenment, that's not true.
That's where the mistake is.
Yeah, if you think that it's going to have an enlightenment experience, that's not true. Like an enlightenment experience, like, I finally got to this room so I could see that painting. Now I'm having an experience of the painting as though it's something that wasn't there before.
I broke through, yes.
Now I'm having an experience of the self. This experience of the self is always there. And so when you recognize that you know very well that you have always been here, you have never not been here, how could I have not known? It's like more like that. It's not a new experience. Absolutely not. And you're very aware of that also.
Can I follow up with that in my own experience? So that having been exposed to the knowledge of the self.
Yeah.
And then sitting in meditation and feeling the tumult of the day fade away.
Yeah.
And the shanti slowly but very beautifully
arising. Yeah.
Really doing it.
Yeah.
And then like, yay, and then yay, okay. Yeah. Being able to let that go.
Yeah.
And then remembering the truth of the self, having gone through some great knowledge.
Yeah.
And then realizing, am I feeling that shanti vritti, or am I feeling me, like in that sense, and the distinction there?
Well, the me never goes away.
It's true, but the feeling, or is it possible to experience the me in any feeling way?
The me is its own feeling. It's just a feeling that, if you want to use the word feeling, that's a feeling that's never not there. So in other words, you can't say, if you're going to say kind of the feeling or affectual changeless nature of consciousness itself, you can't say, well, that goes away with the dukkha vritti. It never goes away. Never. It's always exactly the same.
So the mistake is equating it with bliss.
The bliss that a vritti born bliss is, oh, now I'm so happy, but now I'm happier. Now it's really bliss. Now it's extreme bliss. Those are vrittis. You have to recognize the one who's ever present, no matter whether it's extreme bliss or just mediocre or neutral or depressed. Nothing's happening to me.
What is happening?
There's something happening in the mind.
Yes.
Yeah. If they're states of mind.
What is? So the connection to the self.
There is no connection to the self because there's nothing but the self.
Yeah.
So there's no connection to the self. It's like there's no connection between clay and the pot. There's only clay there, really, but there's that pot, right?
So the separation.
There's no
separation.
There's no separation.
Well, there's an endless dirge in the spiritual and metaphysical world, continuous programming that must be attained.
Yeah.
That you're getting some, you know.
That you're getting, yeah, it's hierarchical.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Climbing the ladder.
Climbing the ladder and all that.
Yes,
exactly. Having a, your whole upadi is becoming more subtle.
Oh, is that when the kundalini rises?
Oh, whatever. But all the subtle stuff is there, but it all belongs to the upadi. You know, and so that's an endless trip, actually. Some of it is good. Like, I think yoga or qigong or these things are good because it's healthy and it gets the system working really well. Same with pranayama. Those things are all really useful because it's useful for the upadi.
Even vipassana can be useful.
Yeah.
For the, what, I mean, it gives you a very tangible awareness of change.
It does. It's only what you think that it will do for you. If what you think it is will do for you is what it does do for you, that's perfect. It's only when you start thinking that it's going to result in something that it's not going to.
Yeah.
That one expression, I just realized, it's a little confusing to me. You say the self-experience.
Yeah, that
because,
when I...
Because who's living that experience? I mean...
There's no... That's true. I'll tell you what the problem is. When I say self-experience, usually I'm talking around that in one way or another. It means, what it means is, in Sanskrit, if I say the self is swatha siddha, it's self-evident, it's self-shining. And what that means is that it doesn't require a pramana in order for it to be known. It requires no means of knowledge for it to be known. It's self-shining. It doesn't require anything for it to be.
Is there anything else like that?
No. There's nothing else like that.
So it's not like the self is having an experience of itself.
Yeah.
That's why the language was confused.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Good.
It's not.
Huh? What'd you say?
It sounded like that to me. Self is having an experience.
No, because there's some dvaita in that. It's, if you say it's self-shining, consciousness is its own experience. Yeah. Words are tricky. You have to keep circling around.
And that's totally not different, right?
Hang on a minute. I'm not getting... Oh, Martina, can you hear me now? I saw my little... Well, let's see. Oh, you're back on. Okay, I see now.
Did she hear everything?
Just about. So, Dejan, you're saying, is the Holy Ghost or Holy Spirit the Atma, Brahman, rather than the mother? I'm not sure what you mean there by the mother. I know you're using Christian terms here, but why would you say the mother there? Holy Ghost or Holy Spirit? Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
You know, my mom became a Catholic, and we used to go to this church, Holy Ghost Church. So what is this Holy Ghost, anyway? This was the Holy Spirit, and what's that? So her description, it sounded like Ishwar. It sounded like the intelligent principle that's operating the universe. Now, I don't know if that's what a definition is, but that was her definition.
Who's asking?
Dejan. I'm not sure, Dejan. Yeah, she says she used to think Holy Spirit as the mother or goddess. Now I'm thinking it as the Atma. It would be like this, the self in all beings. So if you have Ishvara, but the consciousness that Ishvara enjoys is the Holy, somewhat like the Holy Spirit, the Self in all beings. I have to look it up. I read something. There was one Swami who tried to make some parallels between this Trinity and the Satchitananda. I'm not sure that. No, not him. Not Bede Gribbins. No. No, it wasn't.
Or sometimes when she would describe it, it sort of sounded like karma, you know?
Yeah. But I think everybody's just trying to look for a similarity, you know.
There is one in Mexico who has original Christianity, original Tibet. He doesn't think
something like that, yeah.
And he thinks they're all the same. I can refer to that.
Okay.
But she wasn't looking for similarity. I mean, she didn't know anything about Hinduism. That was her.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. No, hang on a second. One more. Then we're gonna go home. Yeah.
So are you gonna walk out of the little bus? Is that where you go?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. Should we say a prayer? Swasti prajabhyat paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmane deshubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyaha prithivi sasya shalini Desho yamsho barahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschid dukha bhag bhavet asato ma sargamaya Tamaso ma jyotir gamaya, mrityor ma amritam gamaya, om purnamadav purnamidam purnat purnamudachate, purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vasishyate, om shanti shanti shantihi. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.